How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back, everybody. If you've been listening for the last 8 minutes, actually, Claude, if you are a Patreon, you get to listen to that fun stuff, correct?
Yeah, patreon.com/chatteronbooks. Sign up today for all kinds of exclusive audio hearings and things like that, all kinds of stuff.
Yes, and not to, you know, we do our best with every minute of this show, but sometimes the greatest stuff, as we often talk about, is the before and after.
You can't plan greatness, you know? You can't plan it. It just happens.
Yeah, exactly. It just happens.
I can't tell you how many times I've done interviews where as I'm just doing a little chit-chat before the interview starts. They say the greatest things, and then, we're rolling now? Okay, say. And I ask them the question, I get nothing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't want to interview anybody before you interview them.
Yeah, I always say I can be funny spontaneously. I cannot be funny on demand.
Right. Right.
Can't
Hard thing
it.
To do. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Welcome back to Chatter on Books, everybody. Hope everybody's doing well. We're cruising through February. I cannot believe this. We have a really cool author on this evening. His name is Mark Wish. He is the author of a book called Necessary Deeds, which I've said before. It is about revenge. It's about redemption. It's about this weird mind-twisting stuff. Really fun book. He has a really interesting life and career. And the dulcet tones you've already heard. Claude Jennings doing the important work. Jamie McIntyre. And the voice you're not hearing is David Aldridge, who is off covering big Commanders news. Claude, do you know that we've got a new coach, do we?
Yeah, the former defensive coordinator for the Cowboys, Dan Quinn. And he's trying to get his staff together. Cliff Kingsbury is going to be running the offense, which is interesting because I didn't realize that Eric Bieniemy was no longer running the offense. And so that's a whole dramatic situation. So I guess he's out and Kingsbury's in. And, you'll see what happens.
Why do we think this coach will be good? What's the theory behind this particular person?
Well, you know, he's had success. You know, he was the head coach in Atlanta when they went to the Super Bowl and choked it away against the Patriots. He had some successful years in Seattle as their defensive coordinator, Legion of Boom with those guys. Yeah. And then, you know, the last three seasons with Dallas, he had a top defense all those 3 years. And some thought that going into this year that Mike McCarthy would be fired and Dan Quinn would be the head coach in Dallas. That didn't happen. And so you figured once Dallas is out of the playoffs this year, he was going to go and seek the head coaching job. We will see. You never really know. I mean, Cliff Kingsbury is kind of the same way. I mean, you know, he was Patrick Mahomes' coach in Texas Tech. And so he's kind of like a quarterback whisperer, they say, I guess.
Yeah.
But he wasn't really successful as a head coach in Arizona. You at USC did pretty decent with their offense. But, we'll see. He's supposed to be one of these, offensive gurus, these young guys. And we'll see.
Whenever I hear somebody was really good in college, quarterback, there's a difference. There's a big difference.
Yes,
and a coach and a quarterback coach have a different relationship. They have a different standing. It's a very different world. Okay, rolling along with Chatter on Football. Jamie McIntyre, when's the last time you've been to a Commanders, before that, previously known as the Redskins game, at FedEx Field?
It's been at least 10 years.
There we go. Claude?
I went twice 2 seasons ago. Now, last year, I couldn't go because I was working the post-game show with Scott Jackson and Fred Smoot for the radio network, so I couldn't go. But 2 years, 2 seasons ago, I went to 2 games.
Okay. I think it's been 15 – it's been at least 10 years. And I've been to FedEx Field. It wasn't for a Commanders game. It was to see Notre Dame play somebody, University of Maryland or something like that.
I was only at FedEx Field once.
And it was not a good experience,
exactly,
correct?
I can pretty much tell you, though, it's when somebody invited me who had tickets.
Yeah. Well, as I say all the time about FedEx Field, if Claude called me up on a Thursday or a Friday and said, let's go to Chicago on Sunday to see the Commanders play the Bears, I'd be like, yeah, sure, great, let's go. He calls me up on a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday morning and says, let's go to FedEx Field. Like, no.
You're not going?
It's a very unpleasant experience.
Well, speaking of two of those days you just mentioned in that scenario, Wednesday and Thursday, you were somewhere –
such
all
a good segue.
Fun doing something, right? Last week, Wednesday, Thursday, what were you up to?
Don't hate me. Pebble Beach.
Oh, Tori.
Those of you watching a news channel,
you were there?
Look of rapture on Claude's face.
Because I've got a lot of bucket list courses to play, and I've played some of them, but Pebble is coming up, I think, in another 2 years with my guys that we go on these trips. It's on the schedule, just haven't been there yet.
It is so worth it. Golfer, non-golfer, you know me, I'm the best amateur fan of everything, and I play golf twice a year. It's just one of the most spectacularly beautiful places you've ever been. Just set aside the golf course, but that'll come back to it. It's just a beautiful part of the world, beautiful part of California. And then the golf course. And then I started asking people, because I was there for a couple of days. I was asking different people who were involved in actual golf and saying how, you know, there's so many things you can be distracted by as a player. And at that level, what is this like? And the pace of the game is slower at Pebble Beach, whether it's people who pay $650 a round to go play there like you and your buddies will, or in a tournament, it is slower because it is so distracting.
They say if you go out on a guy's trip, you got to plan for your round to be 5.5 hours because you're going to be taking pictures. You're going to be looking around. Yes. It should take you 4.5 hours and add another hour and a half because you're going to take pictures. And people are okay with it. They're all right with it because that's what you're there for.
Well, they are so okay with it. Several people were telling me the story. I can't remember when this was, but Jack Nicklaus is out there playing with somebody and say they, you know, drove off the third tee or whatever. And there's several. Everything is beautiful. There's several iconic holes. And he'd say, okay, hit the ball. Now walk backwards and look back what you just saw. Mm-hmm. Just spectacularly beautiful. And there, you know, there are a lot of different sports that I like, but the history that goes along with that game is so cool. And people who are at the top of the game right now are trying to do is carry some of that history forward. It was just so impressive. And in the world of being small and Tony Kornheiser littles, I'm putzing around on Thursday, minding my own business, walking from one place to the other, whatever, you know, where's the beer tent? And I hear the story and I look over and it's Rob Stronach.
Oh, get out of here. Yeah.
Get out, right? Jamie, do you know Rob?
I do not.
Rob is one of the original Tony Kornheiser loyal littles, right, Claude?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Former manager of the Hay Adams. I think he's retired recently, he told me. But I turned around, he's got the TK hat on, and it's just, you know, out of context. But it was great to see that. It was kind of a guy's thing for him, too. He's always wanted to be there.
Sweet.
I highly recommend the experience for anybody, golfer or non-golfer. Just go. And even if you just go for a morning and you walk around, the pro-am stuff was really fun.
My stepdad, who never watches golf, couldn't care less about it, was flipping through channels, obviously, on Saturday. And, you know, there's nothing else on. There's nothing on television. And so he stops at golf for a second. And I started getting these flurries of text messages from him. And he's talking about, he says, have you ever heard of Pebble Beach? And I'm like, yes. Have you ever been there? No, but it's on the list. He says, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And he's mesmerized by this on television. Yes. And he doesn't care anything else about it. He doesn't care about golf. Like, it was the funny thing that, have you heard of this course? Have you heard of Pebble Beach? Like, yeah. Yes.
Oh, great.
Yes, Dad, I have.
Everyone should go. Put it on your bucket list. Okay.
I wasn't going to brag, but I was going to say I could make it through the course and definitely in an hour and a half because I don't play golf and I would just be sightseeing.
I was with some real golfers and we were watching the pro-am on Thursday. And one of the things I like about the game is people are very supportive of everybody because they know how hard it is. Claude, you know this. You could be having the best day of your life for 16 holes and then it's a disaster or vice versa, that kind of thing.
Oh, 100%.
But everybody knows how hard it is. And so there's a real appreciation for the players as they're coming through. Tom Brady was in the pro-am. Not the greatest golfer in the world, but people were just so admired him for being out there and trying. Mm-hmm. And even when he hit a bad shot, it's like, ooh, go.
Yeah. Okay. No. Not many villains in the game.
There we go. Okay. Pebble Beach. So Manny's got to go. How's my man, Manny?
He's doing good. He's doing great. He's gearing up for his spring season coming up. And so, he's doing his thing.
When does it start?
So he starts team play in March with his PGA Junior League. And then his Mid-Atlantic PGA Junior Tour events start in June. There's about 14 events for him to choose from. I think we're going to put him in like maybe eight. So, he's going to have a busy summer.
At what age can we start discussing Chatter on Books NIL, name, image, and license?
Is it early? We can discuss now, whenever you like.
He's so great.
He's starting to pull his weight around here a little bit with these books. And so it's time for him to become revenue positive.
Okay. Now we can pretend to talk about books. So Manny has a great book. And you shared with me something that Manny got in September. The letter.
My apologies for being late on that. No. So we come home one day and I go check the mail as one does when they get home. And we get a manila folder, and it says, well, an envelope, and it says, you know, has our address stuff, says from the White House. I'm like, well, what is this? And so we open it up, and it was a letter from President Joe Biden saying he heard about Manny's book, It's Okay to Be Me, and how he loved how he continues to talk and does this YouTube stuff, even though he stutters, mm-hmm. and through his stutter. And he said that, you know, he stuttered as well, and he got over his stuttering by reading Irish poems and wished Manny the best. And yeah, it was a really cool thing. It was a really,
really,
really
great.
Cool thing. Yeah.
That is
awesome.
So great. So everybody, it's a fabulous book. And
he's got a couple schools in DC that he's doing a reading at this week. And so he's going to do a couple readings this week in DC and try to inspire the youth of America.
Well, and he is. Jamie, what was the most inspiring thing you were doing as a 10-year-old?
I believe it or not, I actually wrote the president when I was a 10-year-old.
Oh, wait, was this LBJ or Truman?
Yes, LBJ. And we were, you know, it was during the Cuban Missile, after the Cuban Missile Crisis,
right.
And Kennedy had been assassinated. And my mom was very worried about the world. And I wrote a letter to President Johnson. And I got back a picture signed by President Johnson, like a lithograph. And it took me a while, but I think I finally determined that this was actually not signed by the president, but a close aide to Lyndon Johnson had perfected his signature and used to sign lots of stuff for the president. But
so
I
he was
thought,
the human auto pen, right?
Yeah, it was a human auto pen. And I was doing research. I was doing research for a story about LBJ at the LBJ Library in Austin, Texas, and I mentioned this to the archivist there. That I had written this letter to the president when I was 10 years old, and they went and found the letter. They had it.
Oh,
so
nice.
Great. That is so great.
They gave me a copy. I said, how could you possibly have found this letter? And they said, well, every letter to the president is just simply alphabetized by the name of the person who sent it. So they just,
wow.
Yep, and it was there.
That makes me think one of these days I want to go back. They say if you've had background checks, security checks, et cetera, done for various jobs in the government, that you can get them. You can access them. And
Oh,
I want to go do that at some point to see what my friends and neighbors said about me when
cool.
people are going, right? Because I don't think it was all complimentary.
Okay.
Yeah. Didn't we have to do, so you're a Pentagon correspondent. Didn't they do some kind of background check before you could run around that building?
They did, but it wasn't as intensive as if you I had neighbors who actually worked for the Marshals Service, and that the background check they got, you know, they came and interviewed everybody on our street to ask if these were nice people or not. They
Yeah.
Were. Wow.
Okay. True story. We are, and I think our author is here. True story. Maybe one of the first times I went for one of those jobs, background check. And you have to, I was in my early 20s, and you have to write down everywhere you've lived, which was not hard because I hadn't lived in that many places. Then you had to have 10, 15, 20 people who could say they knew you over an extended period of time and these kinds of things, whatever. My friends Sally and Steve, who I had known since I was 14 years old, lived kind of out in Herndon, Virginia. And long story short, one day they get a phone call from someone who identifies himself as Officer so-and-so with the, you know, U.S. Marshal's office or something weird like that, calling from Dulles Airport. Like, huh, and this is in the days when people used to pick up their phones.
Sure.
So I'll tell you something about my friend Sally and Steve. They listen to this person, and the person, and they go, okay, hi. And the guy says, we'd like to talk to you about Tori Clark. Well, the first thought that flashed to their head, and this was based on nothing, was that I had been apprehended at Dulles Airport by the U.S. Marshals or something like that for something bad.
Right.
They didn't know what, but they were confident that I had been nabbed at Dulles Airport because that's where the guy said he was. And so they denied knowing me. Which
well, they were protecting you.
It
they
raised
were
a
you.
Whole host
oh, no,
of
we don't know.
A whole lot of questions on that one.
A whole lot of questions.
Come on, yeah. Bell. No,
yeah,
sorry.
That did not
sorry.
Go well.
Doesn't ring a bell.
You're not going to get us to testify against our friend.
Okay, we're going to save several of our things for the next show because we've got some good things to talk about that Jamie has surfaced recently, like how hard it is to be a writer these days. Then we're going to do a thing about the books that are most checked out at the New York Public Library, but we'll do a pop quiz. Okay, New York Public Library, 125 years. What's the number one checked out book? Claude first, then Jamie.
I'm guessing it's gotta be some sort of classic. I'm thinking anything, something William Shakespeare. Am I close?
Think younger.
Younger than that. Oh.
Yeah,
Yeah, it's
kind
got
of
to be a
older.
children's book because they get checked out more.
They do get, that's part of the criteria. This children's books get checked out more. So what's your guess, Jamie?
I don't know. So, Good Night, Moon,
Charlotte's
Well,
Web, The
okay. Cat in the
Maybe.
Hat.
Okay, so number two, I'll come back to number one. Number two is The Cat in the Hat.
Okay.
Sure,
All right.
absolutely. Then you got 1984. Sure, George Orwell. Where the Wild Things Are. And yes, there's definitely a bunch of To Kill a Mockingbird. Absolutely,
Oh,
absolutely.
yeah.
Charlotte's Web, keep going. Got them all. Good Night Moon is down, is like number 11. Number one, I had never heard of this book, The Snowy Day.
Oh, yes. Oh,
The Snowy
yes.
Day.
You
That's
know
a
this?
great book. And the video version is also terrific.
Never heard of it. What's it about? I can read, but
A
what's it
snowy
about?
day, and it's about a kid who goes out and just enjoys a snowy day and goes around his neighborhood, and it's delightful.
Well, it's now because of global warming, it's going to be ancient history. So it'll be in a different category. Michelle.
It's a very family positive, neighborhood positive story with really nice pictures, and it's a very charming book. In a way, it's also charming. You know, the book The Snowman, or the video The Snowman, where the kid gets on the snowman and they fly around with music.
No, no.
Apparently, you don't have any children of a certain age, I'm guessing. I have grandchildren, so I've seen all these things.
Wow. Well, don't try to check them out. Okay. I see. Can you guys see on the top of your screens? I see a C, which doesn't to me seem like Mark Wish, but maybe it stands for something else. Hi, Mark Wish. I'm Tori Clark. Welcome to Chatter and Books. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tori.
Thank you for joining us. Okay. So, really interesting background, Mark. And we have a lot of authors that have done different things, and sometimes authors use a law career or a career in science where to launch their writing careers, but you've been kind of a writer through and through, right? Give us the Mark Wish backstory, including the name change, if we can ask about that. But give us the backstory. Where are you from? What did you want when want to be when you were five? Those kinds of things.
Where I'm from, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the poor side of
Nice.
the tracks, South Side, very segregated, born in 1958. So as they called us, the Polacks, and we didn't like it. We were all on the South Side with the SKI at the end. I heard a zillion Polish jokes growing up, still do sometimes. And that quickly answers your question about the Wish from
Huh?
Wisniewski. Just too hard to Google. So selling books wise, that was the final reason.
Really?
But too hard to spell, too hard to say. And yes, some stereotyping of me that I kind of got tired of. But anyway, born and raised there. What did I want to be when I was five? Pretty much wanted to be a baseball player or a basketball player, as any kid pretty much in my neighborhood wanted to. This was a blue collar neighborhood. The way you got out, was to be, the next Joe DiMaggio or whatever. That changed quickly when I went to my parents, big believers in education, so went to the prep school on the other side of town. My parents wanted me to go into law. Again, that was kind of how to make it. So I had this thing on, but being on the debate team, which I was a natural for, but wanted to play basketball. At that school, you had to choose one or the other. Went to ended up going to Georgetown Law, sort of as a result, and just to kind of show you that I always did want to be a writer, though at some point, I think in undergrad, I took a year off between getting into Georgetown after undergrad and going there to write my first novel. Hitchhiked across the country to get my material. Didn't really use much from what happened in the hitchhiking trip. Wrote a novel anyway. Tried to write a novel, revise it, and get an agent for it all in less than a year, which is, of course, as we all know now, is kind of a silly thing. But that's how much time I had. Went to Georgetown Law and was never quite in it. Got jobs. I worked for Congressman Zablocki on the Hill, writing correspondence,
Sure.
the National School Boards Association, writing for them. Any writing job I could find, I took. And so it was sort of odd going to Georgetown, paying that tuition, and not having a lot of money to begin with. I got some scholarship help, but it's a lot of student loans. And I was sort of living my parents' dream and mine at the same time. So it was an odd sort of confused first 24 years, I would say, of my life. Then I pretty much was into writing and or teaching writing, which is a lot of writers do, you know, pretty much till now. And then, and of course, book doctoring. So if you guys read Necessary Deeds, you know a little bit about that. And so my material from that came from that side job. That's probably where I've made the most money, you know.
Well, in another show, and you'll have to come back, we'll talk about, because Jamie surfaced a few weeks ago, a really interesting article about how hard it is to be a writer. Always has been, but even harder now.
To make a good living at it.
Yeah, to make a good living.
Almost everybody has to have some other means of support.
Yes. Yes.
Unless you're Colleen Hoover, in which case you're gangbusters.
Exactly.
Okay, what kind of lawyer would you
do? My wife is a VP in interior design at Random House. She designed Barack and Michelle Obama's book, Rachel Maddow.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
And we were just talking about it. We're driving on our way today to AWP in Kansas City to sell this anthology that we both put together every year. And we were talking about Colleen Hoover and how she just sort of end-arounded the entire publishing industry. And, you know, we were trying to get to the bottom of precisely how she did that. Did she use the Amazon algorithm or did she use the Twitter algorithm? Frankly,
no. We've talked about this, and then we should talk about Beatrix Potter, because Colleen Hoover and Beatrix Potter, so similar. Mm-hmm. So Colleen Hoover, because go through any airport, which I do all the time now, regularly, just crushing, right?
Five of the books that are on the
shelf.
Yeah. So she was a social worker and, you know, going along doing good deeds as a social worker and was just kind of writing for the fun of it. And then she just kind of self-published and she gave them to some friends and the friends gave them to friends and these kinds of things. And it started to take off on TikTok. It wasn't even, she's beyond everything else, but she was a self-published author. And then it starts to take off on TikTok and she became a star on TikTok. And all these young people, 20-somethings, primarily women, but not exclusively, on TikTok were talking about how great these are. And that really started to go. And then the major publishing houses came after her. So now the Beatrix Potter connection, which we talked about a few weeks ago, Beatrix Potter was late 20s, maybe 30, 31, interesting woman from kind of a well-off family, but she wanted to make her own way. And so she would do different things. And she started to write these stories. And she came up with the first one about Peter Rabbit. But she sent off 20, 30 different letters, et cetera. Nobody wanted her book. So she self-published. She went to a printer, got the first, I think, couple hundred copies made and gave those out and then sold a few. And one thing led to the other. And brilliant woman that she was. She knew how to market things even back then. She came up with the idea of toys. She came up with the ideas of all sorts of merchandise to go along with the book. So
I know we would get to Mark's book, but I just one quick story from my time at CNN. We had this really smart show producer who produced a lot of the weekend shows at CNN. And he announced one day that he was going to quit his job. He was going to go write novels. And we all rolled our eyes and said, you know how hard that is. Right. Yeah, we're all going to quit and just write novels. And we kind of said, you know, good luck with that. And that show producer was named Dan Silva.
Oh.
And as Paul Harvey would say, and now you know the rest of the story.
Well, that's like Claude. I'm sorry. Can you look this up? The guy who wrote Marley and Me, and I feel terrible because I tell the story, but I can't remember his name. The guy who wrote Marley and Me was a Philadelphia Inquirer reporter. And I used to be in and out of the Philadelphia train station all the time. And often on a Friday afternoon, I'd be sitting in the train station waiting to come back to D.C. and would go into that newsstand to get whatever, Diet Coke, some magazines. And there was this sad looking man at a fold out table and people were bumping by him trying to get their, you know, candy bars or whatever. And he had all these books piled up. And I'm like, oh, who are you? What's your book about? And his little shoulders went down. He goes, oh, it's about my dog. And you know, I'm a reporter. And I was supposed to be writing about this. And I had an agent and I was supposed to be writing about, I don't know, you know, aardvarks or something like that. And he goes, but my agent called me one day and said, all you do is tell me stories about your dog. You have to write about your dog. He goes, but nobody cares. And I've got this book. And he was so sad. And I just like, I love it. Literally 10, 15 copies. I took whatever copies he had on his table, bought them because I felt so sorry for them. Schlepping them back on the train, handing them out to people on the train. It was Marley and Me.
John Grogan.
John Grogan. There we go.
So these are original, like, pre-first edition even copies that you have?
No, I think they were his first. Well, I don't have them anymore because I gave them to everybody on the train.
Okay, there you go. Oh, I see.
I randomly, but it must have been the first printing for sure.
Right.
Sure. And one of those first, somebody recently auctioned off one of Beatrix Potter's first ones that she self-published and gave out and sold to a handful of people. And it went for many millions of dollars, I think.
See, okay. But what's interesting about, I think maybe all three of these stories, my thought was, you know, because we're right in the middle of, you know, marketing and promoting Necessary Deeds. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of talk about the Amazon algorithm and the Twitter, you know, social media, and you got to get in the feed, blah, 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 get the likes and all that. And I'm going to guess just from what you're saying about these three situations, it was the story really that did it. Because the first thing you mentioned was word of mouth. It doesn't sound like these were wizards about social media, these authors. It sounds like they just wrote compelling, engaging kind of stories that got to the heart. And then I think thankfully that because they had maybe friends and family who were very supportive, and that could be an issue, you know, then it just kind of went from there.
Yeah.
That's my guess. That's from what you're telling.
And the two things about the story I told, one is it was a pre a lot of the social media. TikTok and Facebook, right, and Twitter, and there wasn't around then. Two, the other thing that when I've told this story to other authors over the years, mm-hmm, about Dan Silva, almost all of them were like really envious and didn't, mm-hmm, understand how come their book.
Yes.
What was it? What was the thing? How did he have some sort of inside connection or something? Because a lot of authors write really terrific books and they never, you know, they don't go anywhere.
That is a great segue, Jamie, to Mark's book, Necessary Deeds.
Excellent segue.
Because there's a lot of resentment and jealousy.
Yes.
And anger in Necessary Deeds. So I have to let Jamie ask the Jamie McIntyre question on this show. Jamie?
What is the book about?
The book is about it's about really it's the old love versus hate theme, which I think any good book is about. And I really think there has to be a love story in just about any piece of writing, all the way down to poetry. But there's that's there. But it really is about ambition and versus the teamwork approach. I mentioned about how I played sports when I was a kid. I was brought up with this. Especially with basketball, you all play together. That's how you win. If one person steals the ball, you lose. You might score a lot of points in the game, but you lose. And I took that attitude into publishing when I, you know, ended up in Manhattan and you know, getting my agents, writing my novels and all that. And it's really only in the last few years. And I think as I was writing Necessary Deeds that it occurred to me. And, you know, watching what's happened with my colleagues and other people I've known, and also what's happened that I've observed as a book doctor, which is helping other people get published, that the people who succeed tend to be the ambitious sorts. So the cutthroat approach. I mean, it's a sort of a cynical thing to say, I think, but it generally bears out, or so it has seemed to me. And I think this book keys on that, or it presupposes that. And it says, what happens when you have, our narrator is more of a teamwork person. He talks about that's why, you know, making something better with somebody else than either of you could make by yourselves. You know, that's the reason he got married. That's the reason he was a book doctor and an agent. And so you have that sort of ideology versus the ideology of certain authors. These particularly in Manhattan in this book, who, you know, they're just all for themselves and look out for them. If you get in their way, too bad, you're in trouble.
Okay, vocabulary matters. We're all familiar with ghostwriters. You refer to book doctors. You refer to yourself as a book doctor. Help us understand the book doctor.
What does a book doctor do?
A book doctor is sort of between a ghostwriter and a very thorough copy editor, in the sense that I have not ever written anything for anyone from scratch. In other words, no one's ever came to me and said, okay, here's this person, you know, it's a celeb. So they want you to write, you literally write the stuff. They'll talk, you write, right? In my mind, that's a ghostwriter, may or may not be acknowledged on the cover of the book. the book doctor's in between, and it's kind of, in the way I've done it, generally I've done it secretly. That's the part of the deal. That's why I've gotten paid more, because part of it is to keep it secret. And that this is for people who a lot of times have a novel or have written several of them, and they even have an agent, and they've been just missing at the major houses. And the agents can't figure out what's wrong, or the house editors are too coy or shy or vague about why they're turning the person down or the manuscript down. And it just kind of got out that I was pretty good at taking particularly novels. I also did it with short stories. And, you know, if the whole ending needed to change, I would think up the ending and sort of sometimes write part of it, sometimes tell them what to write, and then help them, you know, refine the voice of it or make sure it's consistent with the rest of the book. But I would divide it into the macro level and the micro level. And it was a very, very thorough line. So it was ultimately kind of a proofread. That's how nitty gritty I got. But I, you know, I just revised the hell out of these books as I would my own. And okay, the word kind of got around, and I just started being able to charge more and more per page, because I was also writing my own fiction. And sometimes I would be like, I can't do this. I'm in the middle of writing my own novel. And they're like, well, what if we pay you $30 a page, double space page? And I'm like, okay, I'll do that. You know, you're trying to pay the mortgage. I had to pay off the student loans. My brother's passing away kind of helped that situation out a little bit, but there's still a lot of student loans to pay. There's mortgages to pay. And so when it came down to it, if somebody would pay me enough, I would drop what I was doing and do this for them.
That just seems like a really rare talent. It seems like you could get a proofreader. You might be able to get an editor. You might be able, as you said, get a ghostwriter, but you know, it's like you're the hat trick, the triple play.
Yeah.
My wife is a really excellent proofreader. She has one of these brains where she can spot every misspelled word and every punctuation error. And that in itself is a rare talent. She rarely runs into anybody else who's able to do that.
Right.
So this, where you're really sort of fixing and improving and, you know, editing, it's, as a reporter, of course, every reporter appreciates a really good editor, because they make your stuff so much better, except for the ones that don't.
So I think we take Book Doctor literally, and he makes these books, this writing, healthier.
Yes.
Right? Healthier and better.
Really, so more
a book coach too, I guess.
Yeah.
Coaches help you.
Yes, you could call that, because at some point I would have to, the number of changes I would suggest, and it's particularly if they, you know, any writer knows, you fall in love with your writing. I still do with mine. And somebody comes in and says, you know what? You thought this ending was terrific. It's not. I think this is why nobody's biting for this book. So how about you just cut out this last 100 pages and let's go in this direction instead.
You have
these
to murder your darling.
Pages, let's do these. Yes. I mean, it's a heartbreaking thing to hear. So, it does. I do think it makes it healthier. The main thing also is I'm always thinking about story. I mean, the very thing I said before, let's make this compelling to the heart, not so much to the mind. Cause I do think that's really what gets for novels, for fiction. That's what, you know, it gets you the book.
Okay. Great story in Necessary Deeds. And Mark, I have to tell you, when I was reading it, which I love, I was going back and forth between the book, which I did not put down, and Googling you and reading more about you and other stuff you've written. And I thought, okay, short of, I hope, so our hero had spent some time in Sing Sing for a crime of passion, and then it's what happens afterwards and revenge, redemption, etc. Absent the crime of passion, I hope, because I don't think you spent 4 years at Sing Sing.
No.
This book was kind of autobiographical.
Yes and no, because the protagonist is an agent. And you could say a book doctor is sort of like an agent. I'm a big believer in not writing novels or short stories about writers. Uh-huh. Again, my wife and I published this annual anthology, Coolest American Stories. And the manuscripts we get, I'd say about 90% of them are about writers or about professors at MFA programs.
Well, aren't you supposed to write about what you know, so writers write about
Well, that's where I'll just beg to differ right there. I mean, And considering its MFA programs where 90% of the writers are coming from, whereas if you go back 50 years, that wasn't true. You came out of being in the war. You came out of being a war correspondent. You came out of whatever. You didn't go to, you know, the 300. Even when I was coming up, when I was getting out of undergrad, trying to figure out, it was either you got into Iowa or forget it. And I didn't get into Iowa on the first track, you know. But I don't think if we published in Coolest American Stories or if I just wrote about my life, I don't really think it would be that interesting.
But you did. You did. You wrote about many aspects of your life. And here's one piece in the series I asked about and how challenging this was. Because in the book, without giving too much away, our hero shares some writings from other people.
Right.
Portions of short stories, etc. And it becomes like Inception. So much in life is like the movie Inception, these layers upon layers. And I would stop myself and going, okay, when Mark was writing this and he has to write something that he doesn't think is very good because it's coming from someone else.
Yes.
What was that? I've literally never seen this of the many, many authors we've had on. I've never seen this construct before. Was that really hard to do?
No, because again, I've read more books that are, or in the last, let's say 20 or 30 years, I've read more poor unpublished or almost their manuscripts than I have published books. You know, you guys were talking, I was listening to some of your episodes. How many books have you read? And I was thinking, I've read this last year, 2023, three books, two that I blurbed, and I like to read those books all the way through. Well, then I've read a zillion where I go to the look inside on Amazon and get the beginning. And if I like them, then I'll possibly order them. But if not, you know, I'll let them go. And I let a lot of them go. I'm kind of a snob when it comes to what I read. But at the same time, I've just read a lot of subpar writing. So I know what it looks like. I know what it sounds like. So it was not hard at all.
You can capture it. All right, Jamie, I've got to get you out with this question before we do 60 seconds more. But do you have anything for Mark?
No, but can I tell my classic joke about the relationship between reporters and their editors?
Of course.
This goes way back. I think it was from the 50s or something, but I remember hearing it at some point. But it was supposed to illustrate the relationship between a reporter and editor. And the joke, and I'll make this really fast, is the reporter and his editor are stranded in the desert, and they're crawling across the hot sand, and they're dying of thirst. And they look up ahead, and they see an oasis in the distance, and they make their way there. And sure enough, when they get there, it's this sylvan pool of crystal water. And they're so excited, and they jump in, and they're pouring the water over themselves and drinking it. And then the editor gets out and stands on the side of the oasis and begins to relieve himself. And the reporter says, what the hell are you doing? And the editor says, I'm making it better. And that's how most reporters look at their
perfect.
But the reality is, editors, good editors really do make it better, just like good coaches make players better.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Mark, here's Necessary Deeds, great book. And one of my favorite expressions, which I've now stolen and I've been using for at least a week, 10 days since I read the book, is Ferrari brain. So explain Ferrari brain to us.
Ferrari brain, as it was explained to me, and believe it or not, as much as I used to be very anti-social media, was explained to me in a chat from a person who I've never met in person. And I don't know how we got on the subject, but this person said that they were talking to, I think, a therapist who told this person that they had Ferrari brain, which is the tendency of someone to think the worst, you know, to go from one negative thought very, very quickly and go right to the worst case scenario, you know, far more often than is healthy or than is good for them. It's kind of the opposite of positive thinking, but, you know, zero to 100 in a second.
Yeah. We all know people who catastrophize, if that's a verb, but it's the speed with which that happens. And as soon as I read that, I thought, oh my gosh, I know people like that, because it's like this momentum. They want to get to the bottom as quickly as possible. So that's one of my biggest takeaways from Necessary Deeds, other than I loved it.
I think it's a little bit of a post-PTSD thing. I think maybe now with the way things have been politically for, you know, and there's a lot of fear out there, you know, what's going to happen. I think probably the prevalence of Ferrari brain in the average person is, or you know, among people in the United States at least, is a lot higher than it was, say, 20 years ago. If this is true, and I guess this is a thing. I mean, it sounded right when my guy was talking about it in the novel.
Well, you saw it on social, you found it in social media, but now it's yours. So you can own Ferrari brain. You should probably trademark it or something. Okay. Right. Most importantly, what is next?
For me?
Yeah.
It's looking like possibly a sequel to Necessary Deeds.
Awesome. Which means
this was a kind of a move more to the commercial / you know, mystery crime. And I think it might help the book sell more. But there's that literary fiction writer in me. And if I go back, it'll still be a mystery. There'll still be people dying. And he'll still be undercover with the FBI, with Jonas, his buddy. But I think it's going to be a little more serious and a little more maybe going back into his life rather than forward.
There's a great Netflix series in this. A great one. Thank you. There really is. And it's not all, it stands alone on its own, and people should go buy Necessary Deeds. But it really, because you've captured what is really hard to capture. You really don't know how this is going to end up. You really don't. You think you do at several different places, which I thought was fabulous. And I immediately started putting people into it. Okay. Hang out for just a second. We've got to do a little bit of housekeeping. David, we know you're listening. Hope you're having a good time. Claude, Jamie, thank you. Next week, we are back with Lou Ferrante, who his book is Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia. I don't know my personal obsession with the mafia, but it's there. So we're looking forward to that. In the meantime, everybody, go out and buy Necessary Deeds. It is a great book for yourself. It's a great gift. Hopefully do it at your favorite independent bookstore. Claude, Jamie, thank you very much. Mark, great to meet you. Hope you come back with whatever next. Bring your wife next time, because I'm all individual, so we'd love to meet her as well.
Certainly. Thank you so much, Tori. Thank you, Claude, and thank you, Jamie.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
See ya.